Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
U.S. cotton growers may suffer a double whammy this marketing year, not only harvesting a 10% smaller crop than last year at 13.1 million bales, but also getting less money on average for each of those bales. USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Jackanowski says, for most crops, less production produces higher prices. But that's not always true, especially when it comes to cotton.
Cotton is another one of those crops that depends heavily on the global market and especially global demand, tied closely to the, you know, general macroeconomic outlook and expectations for the economy going forward. And that has been putting some pressure on prices lately.
So much so that USDA has just chopped another 3 cents a pound off of its season average price forecast, taking it down to 77 cents a pound, almost 8 cents below last year. Gary Crawford, Washington.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As Americans prepare for Thanksgiving, they will see some relief in food prices for their Thanksgiving dinner. American Farm Bureau Federation's 38th annual Thanksgiving dinner survey finds this year's classic Thanksgiving feast, 410, will be $61.17. That's approximately $6.12 per guest. Represents a 4.5% decline from the historically high prices from last year, driven by a decline in the price of the Thanksgiving dinner centerpiece, the turkey. But despite the year-over-year relief, cost is still 25% higher compared to 2019 prior to the coronavirus pandemic. Farm Bureau Market Basket Survey includes responses from all 50 states and Puerto Rico, collected for the first 6 days of the month, mostly consisting of volunteer shoppers who visit their local grocery stores to survey prices of the various items used to prepare the feast. As part of the survey tradition, which dates back to 1986, volunteers collect price data on turkey, cube stuffing, sweet potatoes, dinner rolls, frozen peas, fresh cranberries, celery, carrots, pumpkin pie mix, pie shells, whipping cream, and whole milk. To reflect an expanded Thanksgiving table, data on boneless ham, russet potatoes, and frozen green beans also collected. When including the additional items, cost of a Thanksgiving meal is up to $84.75 or $8.48 per person. National Cattlemen's Beef Association, or NCBA, joining the Public Lands Council and Washington Cattlemen's Association, alongside other ag organizations, filing comments opposing the Biden administration's plan to introduce grizzly bears to the North Cascades ecosystem in Washington state. Latest proposed rule from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service follows years of opposition from rural Washington communities, cattle ranchers, and sheep producers. They say it's a misguided effort by federal bureaucrats that will not make a meaningful difference to the success of the species, but will impose a severe burden on rural communities and livestock producers. Residents of rural Washington state have long opposed previous attempts to introduce the grizzly bear due to safety concerns. Currently, no bears there. The species already thriving, multiplying in other recovery zones like the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Grizzly bears 20 times more dangerous than black bears. Well, liquidity has become the primary concern among ag lenders for their producer customers, followed closely by farm income levels, and that's according to the 2023 Ag Lender Survey by the American Bankers Association and Farmer Mac. Survey also found that rising input costs, previously ranked as the top concern, past couple of years dropped to the third highest this year. Recession risk remains a middle concern for lenders, despite worries about an economic slowdown over the coming year. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We really need to make sure that we understand that when we're dealing with our planning for the family, for that next generation, it's important to understand what are the income tax effects, what are the estate and gift tax effects, and then how does this affect our amount of payments that we might receive from the government.
Paul Niefer is a financial planner in Washington State on his keys to transition plans.
Because sometimes we come up with these great income tax or estate tax ideas, and we end up costing ourselves money when it comes to ARC or PLC or whatever it might be. So that's just something that everybody needs to be aware of.
He mentions estate taxes. What else?
So here's an overview of our federal estate tax right now, a federal estate and gift tax. We have a gift tax exemption. That means each person during lifetime can give away $11.58 million next year. So in about a month, it'll be $11.7 million. So almost $12 million. Probably I'm going to round it to $12 million. The tax rate is 40%. And it's pretty much a flat tax rate. There's graduated, but really we're effectively looking at if you owe gift tax, it's 40%. But you're not going to owe gift tax until you give away at least $11.58 million, and that's per person. So a married couple could give away really about $24 million of value and not owe any estate or gift tax. And with some of the other ideas that we come up with as far as putting that land into a limited liability company or entity, you effectively are closer to about a $30 to $40 million level and still not owe any estate or gift tax. So this is the gift tax side. The estate tax, it's not an additional $11.58 million. If you give away $5 million during your lifetime, that means when you pass away, you really only have $6.58 million. So it's what we call a unified credit. You can either do it during lifetime or you can do it at death, but you don't get to do it during lifetime and then after you pass away. And again, that tax rate is 40%. Doesn't matter if it's a gift. Doesn't really matter if you do it through your estate.
What about this idea of basis on inherited assets?
So when I pass away as a farmer, my land value gets updated to fair market value. So I might have paid, let's say I paid $1,000 per acre for ground, and now it's worth $10,000 per acre. When I pass away, my ownership share of that land is going to get increased to $10,000 per acre. That means my heirs can go ahead and sell that ground for $10,000 and not owe any tax. Also, other items that are in a typical farm operation, such as finished goods as far as the grain that you have on hand, your cost of growing crop, your equipment, buildings, etc., those also all get stepped up to fair market value. But that's assuming that you have 100% ownership and it's not in an entity. A lot of times we place these assets into an entity, and depending on the type of entity, that entity might get a step up, but the underlying assets will not, such as a corporation, whether it's a C corporation or an S corporation. You really get no step up in value of the underlying assets. So if that corporation sells it, it's still going to owe tax. It's only the shareholders, if they ever sell the corporation, that they're going to get that benefit. And a lot of times that benefit might be a capital loss that they can only take $3,000 per year. So when we create these entities, we need to understand what is the appropriate entity that we really want to use for holding our land? What's the appropriate entity that we want to use in order to hold our farm assets, you know, the equipment and the grain and so on?
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I only wanted to aspire to be the weatherman on TV, and I got to do that in my hometown in the neighboring TV market from Rockford, Illinois to Moline, Illinois, and I did that for 20 years.
Meteorologist turned congressman from Illinois, Representative Eric Sorensen, member of the House Ag Committee.
You know, for me, it was waking up early. Who was watching at 4:30 in the morning? This was agriculture, right? It's the home of John Deere. And for me to actually connect my community with the science that was needed, it was a great place to be. If I could have told my younger self that there's something even greater than your one dream, I'm living it today.
talks about opportunities.
Well, here in Congress, it's working on in the Agriculture Committee on the Farm Bill. I am a proponent of making sure that we utilize E15 all year round to bring the costs down. When we look at, especially coming out of the pandemic, how hard it was for American families to make ends meet, we got to bring the cost of fuel down. And so I am a proponent of that. But it's also working with stakeholders for sustainable aviation fuel. For instance, in my district, I've got the second largest UPS air sorting hub outside of Louisville. I've got the fifth largest Amazon air. They want to spend money. They want to spend money to meet their climate goals. But here's the thing is we got to provide them with the biofuels. And so who are going to be the heroes in this? It's going to be our family farmers. The ones that are going to produce for the biofuels that we're going to need for that next generation. I got O'Hare Airport as well. And so when I go to a farm and farmers are like, wait a minute, our weatherman's now working for us to make sure that we're going to be sustainable into the future. It's a win-win, not just for the district, but for the people I represent.
Sure, there's excitement on the sustainable aviation fuel front, but how do we actually get there?
I'm cognizant of the fact that, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're probably on the menu, right? So I want to make sure that we've got as many stakeholders and farmers at the table and ag to understand, all right, how do we advocate? How do we best solve these problems? And one of the things that I look at is sustainable aviation fuel. Well, look at the number of planes that are flying today compared to just 10, 20 years ago. It's gone up significantly. And these big corporations have set their own climate goals. Well, we have the ability to actually help them meet it. But also these big corporations have set aside funds. And so those funds are going to come right back into our smaller communities. And not only does it help the farmer, but it helps the mom and pop shop in Chadwick, Illinois. It helps the bank that I bank at in Monmouth, Illinois. It is far reaching by making this investment in agriculture.
We're three decades into this century and still trying to bridge the digital divide.
We brought Secretary Xochitl Torres to the district to be able to unveil funding for rural broadband. And what we've got to make sure that we do is that the rural broadband just doesn't go between point A and point B. It's got to hit all of the folks that are surrounding this straight line. Okay, so it's going to be more difficult. It's going to take more precision from the level of the representative to make sure that we're doing this the right way. But look, I mean, we're coming through a pandemic. It's not just the kids had to, parents had to drive their kids to Aledo, Illinois, so they could pick up the Wi-Fi at McDonald's. But also it means if we really want precision ag to work for our benefit, we've got to make sure that we've got good connection out on the farm.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We are probably one of the newest veterinary schools that has opened their doors here in the last few years.
Dr. Blaine Johnson's with the Texas Tech School of Veterinary Medicine in Amarillo.
It's a different take on veterinary medicine per se. So up until the last 10 years or so, there's been a couple of new schools, but a lot of them have been the traditional routes, veterinary education, which I was a graduate of at Iowa State. But now our school here at Texas Tech, we focus on, really implementing a lot of clinical skills into their education. So while they're learning all the normals, the abnormals, they're actually getting integrated with animals their first year. They're doing physical exams. So we're trying to put hands-on learning approach with students and working around that with our education model. And we're working on our third class of students currently. So we have veterinary students in their first, second, and third years here at Texas Tech University.
The Iowa native has some ideas for cows going into winter.
Yeah, so now we're moving into winter. It's still relatively warm currently, but as you can tell, most of the poor and the lack of rainfall we've been having, all of our forage sources have really been depleting. And the maturity of our forage has gone up quite a bit as well. So we're not getting as much out of the forage we have from a nutritional standpoint as we were in previous times earlier this summer. So we need to start thinking about what we have in store so we can carry our cattle over the wintertime and make sure we're not going to lose too much body condition or need to have to bring in more nutrients to supplement any of those cows that require more nutrition because they've either ran down a little too much this summer or weren't getting an adequate amount of forage in the pastures that they were in. So main things we need to start looking at is getting our cows ready. The easiest thing would be to, one, get your cow's pregnancy evaluated by a veterinarian and determine how many open cows you have. And those would be the first cows I'd remove from the herd and try to get them away. That way you have more available groceries for your cows that are actually going to be in production, those being the animals that are pregnant. So that would be the first thing that I would recommend all producers doing, is making sure we knew who was pregnant and who's not pregnant and whether they need to stay in the herd or not. In my opinion right now, with the current cattle market and the way hay prices are, I would move those cattle on down the line that are open. And then second is trying to determine how much forage we have available from our hay stock. So we need to make sure we have an adequate number, because hay is probably going to get pricey again as we move into the later winter months here, and especially if it gets cold. Currently, the weather's been pretty favorable from a temperature standpoint. We haven't gotten too cold yet, but if it gets too cold, that's going to push our energy requirements up a little higher. And our cattle that are entering their third trimester, that's when our highest energy demands are going to be for that animal. So we need to make sure that we know which animals are going to be rolling into that third trimester and determine if we need a supplement on top of our hay, or how much we need to supplement on top of our hay. And we typically evaluate that by doing a body condition score on those cows. So any animals that are falling below like a body condition 5 out of 9, those animals probably need a little bit more supplement going into their gestation here, and try to get them up to that 5 to 6 standpoint before we get into calving. Because typically the first couple of months of calving, those animals are going to lose body condition. So we need to make sure we're at an adequate level or maybe a little above. That way we're not going to lose any more in the subsequent breeding season. And then I guess the last way, a major point that kind of gets overlooked, is water availability. We need to make sure that there's fresh water available for cattle at all time, even in the winter months. You wouldn't think it's as big of a deal, but even though it's cold, they still require water for a lot of bodily functions. So making sure they have adequate water supply is one thing we don't want to overlook, even when it's cold out.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This is something that I see a lot of farmers and ranchers fail to take advantage of.
Paul Niefer is a financial planner in Washington State. He's online at claconnect.com. Talks about annual exclusions.
You need to realize that it's $15,000 per year per donee. Oops, I forgot my spelling. There needs to be one more E on this. It's not done. It's donee. And that means if, let's say I have in my family, husband and wife, my wife and I, we have 4 sons. 3 of the sons are not married, but one of my sons is married with a granddaughter, and we have a grandson on the way. So next year, that would mean we have 7 exemptions, or 7 people that we can give $15,000 to each. That's $105,000 for me, $105,000 for my wife. I had done a column for Top Producer probably 6 or 7 years ago, just discussing what is an annual exclusion, how does it work. And I was surprised how many people I had send me an email or even give me a call. I didn't know. I thought it was only $15,000 that I could give away total. No, it's $15,000 for each person that you want to give money to. So over time, this can be very, very, very powerful. You could have a net worth, let's say, of $20 or $30 million, and you're concerned about estate tax. But if you start taking advantage of annual exclusions and the power of that, does not eat into that lifetime exemption. So this is an extra credit that you get each year. So go ahead and take advantage of that. If you have, like in my case, my wife and I easily could give away $200,000 to $300,000 per year and not eat into that lifetime exclusion. It is indexed to inflation, but it has to go up by at least $1,000 before that next bracket goes up. So the next jump will be to $16,000. I think that might be 2022, 2023, somewhere in there. It should be coming up here in the next couple of years.
Which brings us to the idea of stepped up basis.
Almost all assets get a step up to fair market value at death. For farmers, let's go through the key assets. Land for sure. Buildings, land improvements, the grain bin, the fences, all of those assets get stepped up at death. Equipment. So the buildings, the land improvement equipment get stepped up. The heirs can sell it for that value and not owe any tax, or they can start re-depreciating that equipment that building over 7 years, 15 years, 20 years. That's typically what you're going to see in the farm arena. It's either going to be, it could be 10 if you get trees or single purpose ag structure, such as a dairy parlor, a hog confinement building, and so on. That's going to be a 10-year asset.
One of the questions is, how can stepped up bases be beneficial at end of life?
This can easily eliminate the gain on anything that your heirs may want to sell. You know, for a husband and wife, when the, in our state, we're community properties. So in our farm, if I pass away and my wife inherits some grain that we had on hand that we hadn't sold, she gets to step that up to fair market value, even though technically on paper, I only own 25% of our little farm partnership. That's how we structured it, because I'm on the road so much. She's doing all the work. So I gave her 75% of, or we agreed on 75% for her, 25% for me. But technically, we own it 50-50. So everything inside of that partnership gets stepped up to fair market value. As I mentioned, fixed assets can be re-depreciated.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This year, 12,000 of our brothers and sisters turned 65 a day.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
65 years ago, this was one of the peak years of the baby boom. We get 12,000 baby boomers turned 65 a day right now. So our estimate is Social Security this year will pop up to $1,450 billion. But you see, and that's about a 7.9% growth, even though the COLA is only a fraction of that. You know, last year the COLA was 8.3, and the spending went up 11.1. How to do that? Because of the increase in populations. A decade ago, one out of eight Americans was 65. 2 years ago, one out of six was 65. It's demographics. How often do we ever talk about the reality of our demographics? How many of you saw the article, you know, the Census Bureau put out their report a couple days ago? Did you see what's happening on our fertility rates? Looks like in 15, 18 years, this country has more deaths than births. We have about 40, maybe 50 years. And actually then we roll over and the United States actually might start to have a declining population. It's demographics. And that's part of our job here. But it would require math. So let's actually walk through something that just frustrates me so much, because I believe it's moral to fix it and immoral to avoid the conversation. And the fact I talk about saving Social Security, I get ads. I get attack ads at home because at first, oh, he talked about it. Well, let's attack him. Our model, and it's not 2034, it's 2033. We have a mistake on our boards. I apologize for that. We estimate in functioning, this is 9 years, nine budget years. The very first year the trust fund is gone, the shortfall is $616 billion. Okay, first year, trust fund is gone. So let's go to the solutions we get from our left. Let's just tax everyone over $400,000. We're going to tax them the 12.4% tax, unlimited income, and they get no benefit for it. All right. Except the problem is the best math says that gets you about $86 billion. Remember, 616 is the shortfall. And I did this on a single year to make it more understandable. 616, $616 billion is my shortfall. It's our shortfall. In 2033, taxing everyone over 400,000, the 12.4% tax and giving them no benefit only produces about $86 billion. All right. So let's get rid of that. No cap at all. You get your benefits up to, what is it right now, 160, 200. Next year, I think it's 168. But we're going to tax everyone above that, the 12.3% or 12.4%, but you get no benefits. How much of that first year shortfall would it cover? Remember, the shortfall is $616 billion. You cover 164 of it. 20%? This is the solution we're being given. Does anyone understand the scale and the fact that to recapitalize something that's burning through in a few years, that's $750 billion a year shortfall? What does it take to recapitalize parts of that Social Security trust fund or to actually have enough taxes? I'm going to show you a slide now where you can, in a little while, where you can go to a 20% VAT tax in the United States with all the other taxes, and you still can't get close to covering the Social Security shortfall. Why isn't this place terrified about this? because it's such a great political issue to attack people to try to save it? And is it moral, the fact that in 9 years you doubled senior poverty in America? Because that's what's being laid upon us.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The 2018 Farm Bill has been extended. Over the weekend, chairs and ranking members of the Senate and House Agriculture Committees announced a one-year extension of the current Farm Bill, a measure originating from continuing federal budget debates in Congress that threatened passage of a new Farm Bill by the end of this year. At a recent Farm Foundation forum, University of Illinois professor Jonathan Kappas said Farm Bill's passing in the year of originally intended date of completion has been rare of late.
The Farm Bill in 1996 began in 1995, complicated by budget issues. What became the 2002 Farm Bill really began being debated in 2001, so that stretched over multiple years. Again, what became the 2008 Farm Bill started in 2007. And the current record holder for the longest stretch is the Farm Bill. It got enacted in early 2014, and it really began in 2011. It was supposed to have been reauthorized in 2012. And then the 2018 Farm Bill is actually the only one in recent history that has been reauthorized within the year of the expiration.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.